This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Polinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Sidney Doyle.
Elisar Saliba.
And it is World AIDS Day night here on Queer Voices. This evening, we're going to be talking to Ryan Johnson, lead health educator in organizing all the World AIDS Day events at the Montrose Counseling Center. And then a little bit later, we're going to be talking to Kelly McCain from the AIDS Foundation Houston. And in the second hour,
it's Queer Music Heritage Night, and the special tonight is gay Christian music. And Jennifer was kidding me a couple, 3 weeks ago. Is there any? Yes, there is. Not only do I have an hour tonight on my website, there are 8 hours of gay Christian music.
Really? That's exciting. Yes. That is.
Yes, you know, I was telling J.D., it sounds like he thinks he's Fidel Castro with those long, you know.
It's a separate, at your leisure. There's 8 little segments.
No, that's fabulous. It's really fabulous that you've taken all the time. And I was asking, J.D., how did you find out about these artists?
Well, through internet research. A lot of them I kind of already knew because I've been collecting GLBT music for years and years. But net research, and that's hard. You know, what do you search on? Gay Christian music? You're not going to find much.
Really? So yeah. What did you search on?
Well,
of course, you know a lot of these artists.
I know
right?
the people, and some of them connected me to other people. But
it's sort of like your own Friendster. It's your queer music Friendster. Huh?
Yeah, in a way. So I hope this 8-hour marathon being permanently on my site will be its own resource.
That's great. That's fabulous.
That is. How accepted is their music in the wider community?
I asked a couple of the artists that during interviews.
I guess
you'll have to listen.
All of you will have to listen in the second hour to see what the answer to that question really is.
Well, and sort of speaking on that same subject, in the next 2 days here on KPFT, they're doing archives. The Pacifica Archives is playing a lot of its resources on the air. They're raising money for the archives. But you also send all your queer music heritage to the archives, correct?
I used to.
Oh, you used to. Okay.
they quit thanking me, so I said, they don't care.
I care. It's good stuff.
Well, speaking of World AIDS Day, you have a song to set up.
Yes, it's not an AIDS song. It's a song by a Christian artist to kind of get you in a mood.
Okay.
It's not a song from tonight's show, but it's a song you'll hear on the net version of it. The artist is a local artist, Alan Lett.
From now on,
I'm gonna live for Christ instead of living for the lie. I gotta make up for all the time I've lost, trying to live on my own, trying to be my own boss. Change my mind about everything I thought I knew. I don't do the things that I used to do, like that verse in chapter 5 of Corinthians 2. Out with the old and in with the new. I said it before and I'll say it once more. God opens up a window when he closes up a door. Like this remix, he gives us all a second chance. So now I gotta sing and now I gotta dance. Can't use this gift for evil, gotta use it for good. Don't want no regrets, no good, would or should. Wanna be an example of Christ for whoever may gaze. Gotta give him praise for the rest of my days. Gotta give him praise for the rest of my days. From now on.
Again, that was local artist Alan Lett. His CD from 2004, The Noise Next Door, that was, believe it or not, not your father's Christian music, but it was a Christian song called From Now On.
That was beautiful. With us this evening is Ryan Johnson, who is lead health educator, who's organizing all the World AIDS Day events for the Montrose Counseling Center. So exactly what do you have on store for us?
We've got a lot of different things going on this year. First and foremost, Friday evening, December the 1st at 6 o'clock, we are having a candlelight observance at the Counseling Center.
Mm-hmm.
It's open to anybody who would like to come and say a few words of encouragement, of a memory of someone that has passed away due to complications of HIV or AIDS. And it's just a moment for the community to come together and memorize that this is the 25th anniversary.
Wow,
of
25 years
of HIV and AIDS. So.
So, it's open to the public, correct?
It is. In addition to that, we are also having a HIV awareness at the Montrose Kroger's on Hawthorne and Montrose.
Or Disco Kroger's.
Right, correct.
Disco Kroger's, yes.
And then also at the Heights Kroger on 11th and Shepherd, we're going to, on Thursday and Friday during the day, we're going to be providing free HIV testing at the Montrose location. We're also going to have a table distributing red ribbons, just information on HIV and trying to get awareness out on HIV and AIDS.
Well, you don't look like you were around.
Right.
When AIDS first started in the early 80s.
Right.
But certainly you've grown up knowing about it.
Definitely, yeah. And I've worked at the Counseling Center for the past 5 years now, and I work in prevention education. So I've been very, very busy in the Houston area trying to get just that out, because I do think that that is the great hope that we do have, because HIV is preventable. So that's kind of the message that we're trying to get out to people.
Besides money, what are the real challenges of getting the word out?
I guess besides, you know, yeah, money is definitely an issue, but particularly in the South, there's still a huge stigma associated with HIV and AIDS, and that brings a barrier into education and services, and trying to overcome that is quite a challenge that we focus on. So.
Well, definitely they've talked about how the face of AIDS is changing, but the gay men, are they still, you know, do we have to do a re-education effort for the gay men?
I think we're never going to have to stop educating with gay men. There's a lot of challenges with, you know, the different subcultures, and there's definitely a lot of challenges with within the gay community still today, and particularly with younger gay men. And just as you were saying, you know, you're saying I look young, and you know, I wasn't around during the, you know, the heyday and when HIV first kind of came about, and I think that that's a big challenge, is because a lot of people don't know the history. You know, they don't know what people have gone through and to come to where we are today. And so the younger generations, I think, really have a hard time knowing.
They're complacent about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you noticed a shift in even the last 5 years you've been doing this in the reception of your message?
I think, I mean, you get mixed messages everywhere you go. So, you know, sometimes people are really thankful that you come out and provide the education, and sometimes people can't believe that you said, you know, talking to them about sex and condoms. And so it just depends on really where you go, I think. But basically, it's improving, I would say, receiving the message, but it's still a challenge.
Well, we definitely have a federal government who thinks condoms is a four-letter word, that it shouldn't
right.
be said. In fact, they were installing an educator who was against it at the federal level. And so we're dealing with that. And in fact, they don't even want to fund prevention in many ways
right.
because, you know, especially with sex education. So I know that's definitely a challenge, and we're here in the conservative side. And now the counseling center and I guess the clinic probably work together in doing education at the bars also.
We don't want to overstep and kind of, you know, people's feet kind of thing. So we our grant particularly is for substance abuse and high risk populations and Legacy and some of the agencies, you know, work in the different parts of town and focus on different things. But we also have an outreach department that goes out into the community. In addition to that, we have case management, therapy that's HIV specific, and most recently we have a SPRI program for elders. So we kind of cover the whole gamut as far as the gay community.
What about the Hispanic community? Is there a special program there?
ALMA does a lot of work with the Hispanic community in Houston, but that's a growing, you know, issue is, you know, the language barrier and just the large Hispanic community that is in Houston. But yeah, Montrose Counseling Center serves almost every single population you can imagine. So,
well, we've mentioned that twice, but what's the contact information for the Counseling Center?
We're on the web at www.montrosecounselingcenter.org, and our main number is 713-529-0037. And again, our location is 701 Richmond Avenue. We're just two blocks east of Montrose.
Thank you.
As you're talking about education, I mean, counseling is a very important part of people getting tested, and I think there's even some talk about wanting to do away with some of the counseling, yet somebody who finds out they're positive or even finds out they're negative,
right.
there still needs to be counseling, and that's something
exactly.
that the Counseling Center has been around a long time.
And that is the one thing that we pride ourselves in. All the testing that we provide has counseling built into it, both pre- and post-test counseling. We don't do anything over the phone. Everything has to be in person. And when we test people, we make them aware of the standards that we have, because we don't want any kind of circumstance to arise out of not having the care in place.
Has the counseling changed over the years, do you know?
The grant funding agencies ours has changed recently. We're now doing a more actually intensive counseling sessions than we used to do in the past.
What do you mean intensive?
Much more focus on risk reduction and getting into the kind of methodology of why people are there getting tested, you know, what triggers their behaviors, what can we do to prevent that in the future. So not only are we concerned about testing, you know, to find out their status, but to reduce the risk in the future for them, you know, falling into the same behavior pattern.
And now you said you specialize a lot in substance abuse.
Correct.
And how does that affect the younger generation?
Not only the younger generation, but, you know, substance abuse cuts across every generation. The fact of the matter is a lot of times people, when they engage in, you know, alcohol and drugs, and particularly crystal meth is such a huge problem right now in Houston and everywhere else, that people don't always make the best decisions, and the behaviors associated can lead to, you know, things that when they're sober, you know, they realize, well, you know, when I was high the other day, I did some stuff that I probably wouldn't have done, or, you know, people that I wouldn't have talked to, and, you know, that leads to different things. And a lot of times when I'm testing people, you'd be surprised. They'll say, you know, there was condoms sitting right there on the nightstand. I had access to it. It's not that I'm uneducated on HIV or AIDS or STIs, but I just didn't make the right decision. And so constantly, you know, they say 75% of all infections are related to alcohol and drugs. So,
and some people think, well, there's treatments for it now.
Right, yeah. Isn't that crazy? That especially, that's what we do get with the younger generation, is that
they see
Magic Johnson, and they see people living healthy with HIV.
Well,
and
youngsters don't have an appreciation of dying.
Right.
They're indestructible when they're 20.
Yeah. Well, they always have been.
But the counseling center has been around for, you know, almost 30 years now. And there are other organizations in town that do good as work, you know, and HIV and AIDS. But, you know, we definitely want to make an impact with World AIDS Day this year. So
tell us again about the events that are going on.
Again, we will be out at the Disco Kroger and the Heights Kroger, providing information and HIV testing at the Montrose location.
And this is on Friday?
Thursday and Friday.
Thursday and Friday, okay.
Right, from 10 a.m. to approximately 4 p.m. We also have a paper chain of remembrance that we have going on in the lobby of the counseling center, where it's open to clients or the community as a whole. We can come in and write the name of someone affected by HIV or someone who possibly passed away, or words of encouragement.
Someone you lost.
And we're displaying that on in our counseling center lobby, and they're all linked together. It's made kind of a nice impact. And then, of course, the candlelight observance, which is going to be Friday evening at 6 o'clock, rain or shine, and the counseling center parking lot. Yeah, it's supposed to get chilly this weekend, so bring a coat, and we're just going to have a few moments of silence and remembering those that have passed due to this disease.
Well, great. Ryan Johnson with the Montrose Counseling Center is the lead organizing for the World AIDS Day and their related events. And if you want some more information, you can go to the montrosecounselingcenter.org on the web. And thank you for joining us this
evening. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
They are falling all around me. They are falling all around me. They are falling all around me. The strongest leaves of my the teachers of my life are moving on. Death comes and rests so heavy. Death comes and rests so heavy. Your face I'll never see. I'll never see you anymore. But I'm not really gonna leave you. I'm not really gonna leave you. You're not really gonna leave me. It is your path I walk. It is your song I sing. It
is your strength that helps me stand.
You're not really.
Queer Voices.
And this is JD, and I was very pleased to share that song with you. It's, of course, very appropriate for today. The group is called Positive Voices. They were a chorus out of Dallas, and in 1998, they released a CD called Until It's Over, and we just heard the title track.
With us this evening is Kelly McCann with from the AIDS Foundation, and she's here to talk about World AIDS Day, but also talk about us in general about what's going on in the community concerning AIDS. And why did December 1st become the day for World AIDS Day?
You know, I think in 1988, that was the first World AIDS Day. And as I recall, it actually started off as the Day Without Art. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And it was a day.
We're old. We remember that.
Yes. Yeah. us long in the tooth folk. We remember that. It started as a Day Without Art, kind of to commemorate the impact and the contribution that people living with HIV have in the art world. And then from that, it just kind of had this spinoff to this larger meaning of drawing attention to HIV and AIDS, raising awareness, and also a way to commemorate those who have died as a result of this disease.
Well, is it something that still needs to be done? Of course I know that, but our people, you know, it's like, is it the same thing year after year? Do we do something different? And of course, it's changing, isn't
it? Has the focus shifted?
Yeah.
You know, the focus, of course, it's really twofold. One is that raising of awareness generally across the community, across the world, so that people will realize the impact that HIV is having on their communities and also learn the ways that they can protect themselves and also the ways that they can contribute to helping those people who are already infected with HIV. But then I have to be honest and say that for those of us that work in the nonprofit sector, World AIDS Day is a way for us to remind people who care about this cause that we're out there doing this work and that if they would like to help, we have a variety of ways that they can do that, monetarily, through volunteering, or through just helping us change the cultural view about HIV and AIDS.
Well, how is it raising money within the AIDS world, and especially here in Houston, Texas, where it was always difficult to raise money for something?
Well, true. And you know, just in general, I think those of us that work in HIV in the nonprofit area, I think we're beginning to see some signs of donor fatigue. People, in certain ways, I think, are growing tired of funding HIV or AIDS. They mm-hmm. are looking for some progress and some significant gains in that area. So you're right, Jack. I think raising money is always difficult. But one thing that we've been able to do at AIDS Foundation Houston, this is for many, many years now, we've been having a luncheon to commemorate HIV and AIDS in this community, people that have made a significant contribution in that area. And this year, we're having our World AIDS Day luncheon at the Corinthian downtown, honoring Jackson Hicks, the wonderful caterer.
Oh, sure.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but 24 years ago, Jackson was the first person in Houston to hold an AIDS fundraiser, and he did it for AIDS Foundation Houston in our infancy, back in the early day.
Right. And that was even before the name was AIDS Foundation.
You are right. It was the KS AIDS mm-hmm. Foundation in those days, and Jackson has continued over the years to be a great supporter of those of us who work in this field. So we're honoring Jackson, and then also we're honoring Dr. Mark Klein, and he is the man who thought up and is now heading up Baylor College of Medicine's International Pediatric AIDS Initiative. He is building international clinics for children all over the world. And so we work very closely with him on some of our camp programs, and we thought he certainly warrants an accolade and recognition on this day.
Absolutely. Well, definitely. Now, we've also seen a lot of the smaller organizations either go out of business or being absorbed. And, of course, you know, you're one of the largest organizations dealing with this. Is that partly for efficiency, or is it partly because they can't get themselves funded?
I think you hit the nail right on the head. It's funding. It has become quite a competitive process. I mean, it's always been competitive to get money, but sadly, as the number of people living with HIV, as that number increases, funding is not increasing to keep up with it. So what you have seen is this contracture of AIDS service organizations. I think we have to acknowledge that we've seen it here with the merger of the Assistance Fund and Montrose Clinic into the new Legacy Community Health Services. We have seen the demise of Aves. PWA is experiencing some changes. And I think all of that is because of the more competitive funding landscape. And also, I think that just the cost of doing business, whether you're talking about a nonprofit business or your commercial small business, it is killing small business people, or, you know, around the country, just the cost of trying to do business, insurance, etc.
Right. Yeah. And you definitely have those same challenges.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you think about, one thing I'll tell you I'm very proud of at AIDS Foundation Houston is, you know, we're a nonprofit organization, so nobody working for us is ever going to get rich. They're doing the work they do for a whole other reason. And I'm talking to people on public radio, so.
We understand you know. All that, yes.
But one of the things that we're able to do, and that has always been of great importance to me, is we pay 100% of the benefits for our staff. They have full health insurance, short-term and long-term disability, vision, dental, and it doesn't cost them a dime. But on the other hand, it costs my organization over $450 per month per staff member. So it is quite expensive, and you just think about a small business. Mm-hmm. We have the luxury of having 24 plus years of existence under our belt, and I think that's one of the reasons that we've been able to thrive, is just because we've been in this work longer than a lot of other organizations. But small ones are having a hard time.
How many in your staff?
We currently have 85 on our staff. We're inching up toward that 100 mark, and if things go our way with some grant proposals that we have submitted around to various places, I think we might see our numbers reach 100 during 2007.
Don't people say, oh, don't you get money from Ryan White, you know, what about that?
Well, you know, I have to tell you that AIDS Foundation Houston, we're a bit unique among AIDS service organizations because we don't do treatment. We, at this point, have not even done testing yet in our 24 years of existence. We've always been a supportive services organization. And years ago, I have to give credit to Sarah Selber, a former CEO of AIDS Foundation Houston. Sarah saw the writing on the wall with Ryan White. It is the huge, biggest funder of all AIDS service organizations. But Sarah saw the writing on the wall that Ryan White was going to become medically oriented only. And so years ago, we got out of Ryan White. Basically, we get very little money, primarily for a food pantry we run, a little thing called Stone Soup, and a little bit of employment assistance money. But for the most part, we're Ryan White.
Free
and clear. Yes. So we have a variety of other funding mechanisms, state funding, other governmental grants, and then, of course, private foundations.
Well, its own funding is so subject to politics.
You know, that is so true. Ryan White, you know, every time the reauthorization of the Ryan White Care Act comes up, all of us in this field are on pins and needles, because it is always looming. That sword of Damocles is always hanging over our heads about how much money is going to be cut, or money that will be diverted from one needed program to another needed program. You know, it's the shell game. Instead of increasing the number of dollars so we can meet all the needs, we move the monies around. And an example is employment assistance in the near future is going to go away, because that money will be diverted to services that have a direct link or impact on medical care. And, you know, my way of thinking, you want somebody to become self-sufficient, let's not only get them healthy and keep them healthy, but let's give them a marketable job skill.
Mm-hmm. But right. So you talked a little bit about the services that AIDS Foundation offers. What is the complete list?
Well, sit back. It's a pretty long list. I'll make it brief, though. We have a full array of services around supportive care. We have, as I mentioned, our Stone Soup food pantry. And another one of our core competencies is housing. We are probably the largest provider of AIDS housing in the state of Texas, certainly in the city of Houston. We own two apartment complexes, and we are in the process of acquiring two more. And then in addition to that, we lease three other properties. So in total, we operate seven facilities for people living with HIV.
Now, let me ask you this. Is that sort of ghettoizing people with AIDS?
Well, I think I have to acknowledge that there is a certain resistance by some clients that they don't want to live in a facility that is only for other people with HIV. The flip side of that is that so many of our clients are living in poverty, and we're talking about, and even in my mind, reconceptualizing what AFH is as an agency. We certainly are an AIDS service organization, but frankly, we are a poverty organization. 80% of our clients live on $10,000 a year or less. And so because of that, and the need for safe, affordable housing, quite often the best way for us to do that is through HUD and HOPWA, specifically serving people with HIV. We do have one program now that is not specifically for people with HIV. It's for chronically homeless individuals. So we have begun to branch out into more generalized, scattered site sort of housing. But for now, we have our seven facilities, and we also provide, in addition to that other chronic homeless program we call First Responders, we also provide over $2 million a year in tenant-based rental assistance or short-term rental assistance so that somebody who's in their own apartment mm-hmm. can stay in their apartment. It's a homelessness prevention. Mm-hmm. So we have housing. We also do a lot of work with youth, and that includes our Positive Vibe. It is a program, an outreach program for youth that we inherited from PWA. Mm-hmm. We do a teen leadership forum, and that's something that just started this past June. And it was a summer program, a week-long program, where we take teens who are living with HIV, who frankly no one ever expected them to survive. They were born with HIV. And no one expected them to live this long. And now, wouldn't you know it, they're getting ready to graduate from high school, and now what? Mm-hmm. And so we set up a program to help them identify some career or college choices and help them learn how to live as a self-sufficient HIV-positive adult.
Right. And then what about reproductive issues?
Absolutely. And that's a huge part of it. And, you know, really, I have to admit, Jack, that was the very first seed that was planted around this entire concept of our teen leadership forum, is because we're seeing these kids at our camp that we run, and they have a little breakout session for the older kids called Teen Talk. And we found the questions that they were asking are things like, will I ever be able to have a parent? Or if I have HIV and so does my partner, can we just have unprotected sex? Great questions. But it became very clear to us that these kids had some specific needs that your average teenager just flat doesn't have to deal with. And so we created Teen Leadership Forum, and then we do our camps. We have Camp Hope, which is a week-long camp for kids with HIV. Camp Hug is a weekend family camp for families that are impacted by HIV.
Is there an outreach to street kids, for lack of a better term?
Well, not so necessarily kids, and I'll be honest with you, it's not just Ryan White and the funding nightmares around that. Some of the prevention funding that's available is now getting very restrictive. It's things like they'll pay you, you know, like to sit through the city, the CDC money comes in, but they don't pay us to do much of anything with kids. Frankly, previous years, youth have not been a priority population. Go figure. But we've been charged with serving the MSM, or the men who have sex with men, community. Mm-hmm. We've been charged with serving African-American females. And so because of funding, we're limited sometimes as to who we can really reach. But I'll tell you, we just, as a matter of course, pro bono, if you will, we get out there and just do general outreach, general education, mm-hmm. because it's a socially responsible thing for us to do. One other thing I'd like to mention, since I mentioned Mark Klein earlier, is we do a lot of international work now, or a lot, maybe it's a lot for us. We're operating and funding international camps in Romania. We've done two in Botswana, and next week one of the staff, Mark Cohen, is heading for Malawi, which, I'll be honest, until we started doing this with BPI, I didn't even know where Botswana or Malawi was. But now we are very familiar with where they are located.
Well, and you know, I have not been a big fan of Bill Gates and his computers, but I have to be a big fan of how he's, you know, putting his money into some areas that is not overly sexy. You know, it's, you know, the poor people and people with AIDS, and that he's going to donate an awful lot of money. Of course, it's not enough to solve problems, but it's a good step.
Absolutely, and it's the humanitarian effort that's so drastically needed. I have not traveled all over Africa. I was fortunate to go to Botswana a couple of years ago, and you know, they refer to Botswana as some of the folks that work in Baylor were jokingly referred to it as Africa Light, because compared to most of the other countries in Africa, they're quite affluent. You know, they have diamonds in Botswana. Mm. Well, I should say De Beers is affluent. But you know, I go to Africa, and in a country that is not even the poorest, I see such need. And up until just a few years ago, when Baylor arrived on the scene, Botswana had no treatment for children with HIV. In the history of AIDS, no child had ever received treatment until 2004. And you see such poverty and need. And at the same time, I have to tell you, such extreme generosity and warmth from those people. It is a real, helps you really adjust your priorities when you come back here.
Well, you know, we're talking about Africa, but also our sister city just to the east of us, New Orleans. I mean, everything that been wiped out there, I can imagine that also AIDS education and any type of programs that dealt with HIV must be just gone.
Well, you know, Noel, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting, I'm blanking on his last name, but it is the man, he's the executive director of the No AIDS Task Force. And after Katrina, Noel came to Houston, and I think he actually officed for a short while out of the Montrose Clinic. And we worked with him, too, to try and even set up some sort of a network so he could call staff who were scattered all over the country. And last I heard, and this has been fairly recently, they do have at least a shell of an organization set up in New Orleans, but some pretty tremendous issues, as you can imagine, infrastructure-wise, staff. And then I had a meeting with a guy from the Department of Health in New Orleans, and, you know, something that hadn't even occurred to me before. He was talking about, yeah, our office is okay now. We've got it where it's all right. But in the whole area where his office is, there's still garbage piled up. Or he said, you walk to your car and rats are running everywhere. And
well, the reality is nobody wants to make a decision, you know, and it may not be politically correct. It's like, okay, we're not going to do this. We're not going to rebuild this. But it's just in limbo, so nobody knows.
Yeah.
Where do you see the future going? Now, you've been working with the AIDS Foundation for a number of years.
Right.
You've been around since the early days. What's happening? What do you think? What do you predict about?
Well, I hope I don't sound like Debbie Downer, but, you know, right now I have to tell you I'm a little concerned about the future. And that is because, number one, the funding for prevention is in decline. And believe me, I understand the wisdom of focusing on treatment and getting people who are living with HIV to be healthy enough to be self-sufficient and live a longer life. But I think if we're really going to solve HIV, until there's a vaccine, the way that we're going to have to do it is going to be a three-pronged approach. That is testing, getting people tested. Once they find out that they have HIV, getting them into treatment. And if they are negative, give them the tools they need to stay negative. And so I'm really concerned with the diminishing funding going to prevention, that we may see a resurgence of cases. Just to let you know, this year alone, there's been a 19% drop in funding from the CDC for prevention. So I'm concerned about that. I'm very concerned, Jack, about the increasing rates of infection among people of color, which I know that's nothing new. We've been seeing that trend, but I'm not seeing a lot happen to change that trend. So I have a lot of concerns, but also some hope that the African-American churches will begin to pick up that torch and run with it. And because I think the church is such a central part of that community, the African-American community, that until the pastors begin to say, this is something we have to address.
Well, and you know, that's interesting because the central part of our community for many years were the bars, and, you know, the extension of that was the bathhouses. And in many cities, they did take up the torch in dealing with that. Some, you know, lots of people try to bury their heads and not deal with it, but the bars in many of our communities did take up that.
Absolutely. You know, I even remember way back in the 80s, seeing signs posted at the COPA and places like that. Yeah, take you back a ways.
Yeah, it does.
But you know, I think you're right that it's a good analogy that the bars, they're a central part of the gay community. The churches are a central part of African-American community. So we're already working with a couple of pastors and churches. So I am hopeful we'll see more work going on there. And then I have to say that I'm a little concerned about the complacency that we're seeing in our own community. Increasing rates of infection, maybe not with HIV, but syphilis among young gay men. I think of syphilis as, you know, the forebearer of HIV. And so I really am concerned about not only young gay men, but young people in general, that complacency that we see developing, that I don't want HIV, but if I get it, I'll just take the meds. No, let's really drive home the point that you need to stay away from this virus if you can. And prevention is the key. So those are a few of my concerns, but I also think that there's some hope out there for people living longer, healthier lives. I'm hoping that, for lack of a better word, excuse me, but these almost an HIV welfare state that was created in the very early days when people were dying is perpetuating. We need to make sure that people can be self-sufficient and help them get to that point. And that's something we're trying to do. The idea is not just continue helping you pay your rent, but let's get you the job training so you can maybe get a job that could help you pay your rent.
Well, yes. And in the early days when you were diagnosed, you were pretty much, you stopped working because you're going to die soon.
Yes.
And luckily it has changed.
People were selling their life insurance and so
that's
forth.
That's right. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I even had friends who were forced to quit. I mean, they were perfectly healthy, but because they were PAWS, they were given early retirement.
Well, and there's one other thing I want to throw in there. This is something that Sean Carter was saying, that, mm-hmm. you know, you see these advertisements in the magazines that they're taking this medication, they all look great, so they don't show you the time you're over the toilet thrown up.
Exactly,
know?
Exactly. The daily bouts of diarrhea and nausea. Oh, exactly. Yeah, they've romanticized that. It's like, oh, HIV, I get to go rock climbing.
You know? Right.
You know? Yeah,
right.
I know what ad you're talking about.
Exactly. Yes, we won't name drug company names or anything, but...
As long as there's a restroom nearby. So, okay, the Friday is World AIDS Day,
right.
And let's recap in what's going on with the AIDS Foundation.
We have actually two events that day. One is our World AIDS Day luncheon honoring Jackson and Mark Klein, and that's at 11:30 at the Corinthian downtown Houston. And then that evening, as a part of our Mukuru Arts for AIDS series, that's our series we started 2 years ago now, we are having our Art for Life auction, and it's at the Grimion Gallery. And this is another fundraiser for our community partnerships in HIV prevention. Just as a reminder, we are a partner. We're the partner for Houston with National AIDS Fund. Mm. And they give us money. We then do a 2-to-1 match, and we grant that money back out into the community. And so we'll be raising money through our art auction for that. And this year we'll be giving out three $25,000 awards, or a total of $75,000, to organizations who are providing prevention for sexual and racial minority youth.
Fabulous.
And it's in part because we didn't think that the city and other entities were funding youth prevention enough, so we mm-hmm. decided we would.
And how do we contact you?
Thank you for that. You can contact us by phone at 713-623-6796, or please visit our brand spanking new beautiful website at www.aidshelp.org.
Kelly McCain is with the AIDS Foundation Houston, and she came here to talk to us about World AIDS Day and what's going on at the AIDS Foundation Houston. You're listening to Queer Voices.
There's light holding us together. There's a light holding us all together. Some will say it's faith, some will say it's life. The name doesn't matter, it just doesn't matter. There's a word stronger than the silence. There's a word stronger than some would say it's love, and some would say it's God. But everything changes, yes, everything changes. When you care, when you care, you don't need an explanation. When you care, either you love or you don't, either you will. Sean, when you came out of time, everyone is running out of time. As the river keeps on running, you can live every day, you can die every day. It just doesn't matter. Just doesn't matter when a hand reaches in the darkness. When a hand touches you in the darkness, it may be a friend or someone you don't know. Which one doesn't matter? It just doesn't matter when you care. When you care.
Yes.
This is J.D. again, and we've just been listening to Positive Voices, a chorus out of Dallas. And by the way, that 1998 is still available at the Cathedral of Hope bookstore in Dallas. I just got it about a week ago. We just heard Positive Voices singing When You Care and The Face of Love.
Well, J.D. again, I mean, next hour coming up is your queer music heritage about
gay Christian music.
Gay Christian music. But next month you have two
queer Christmas music. It's all queer.
Isn't that being redundant? Yes, it is, isn't it?
But this is music. This isn't like, you know, Mitch Miller. This is queer artists, GLBT artists doing music you won't be sick of because you won't hear it anywhere else. You won't hear it on Clear Channel. You'd hear it on this queer channel.
And I am sure most of our audience don't know who Mitch Miller was.
Well, that's maybe true.
That's probably good.
If they're over 40, they may.
We definitely like to thank our guest tonight, Ryan Johnson, who is with the Montrose Counseling Center, talking about the events going on for World AIDS Day. And, of course, Kelly McCann from the AIDS Foundation was telling us about what's going on at the AIDS Foundation. Coming up next week, we're going to have David Elliott in the first hour talking about stuff going on in Washington.
I'm sure he'll have a lot to say.
Yes, and it'll probably be exciting. And for once in the past 6 years, he was right.
Well,
he predicted...
Not by the margin, but you know, he predicted, like, you know, more seats would be taken, but, you know, he always does.
He's always optimistic.
He got it a lot closer than he has in the past.
Very optimistic. So the next hour will be with Queer Music Heritage. We'd like to thank everybody for listening this evening.
Thank you.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Judge the cruel, heals the broken heart. This is Clear Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Clear Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and tonight's show will focus on gay Christian music. Okay, that's the short title. On this show, I will showcase Christian music by GLBT artists, and this itself will cover various music genres and span several decades. I believe this genre has been very neglected, and I hope to showcase the richness of this music. My feature interview is with Marcia Stevens, often called the mother of contemporary Christian music. I could not begin to do a show like this without her, and we'll get to that interview in just a while. I started the show with the song Show Me in Red by Christian Andresen. That's from his 2005 album, The Rhythm of Life, and I think it captures fairly well the attitude of GLBT artists singing to God. I asked Christian to talk about how he wrote that song.
The reason why I wrote that song was because one day I was in my truck driving home and I heard this radio program called Dawson Live. And after a few minutes I surmised that it was a Christian radio program, call-in show. And the topic that night was homosexuality and Christianity. Well, about a couple of minutes later, this kid called in. I would say he was no more than about 15 or 16 years old. And he was talking about how he believed inside of his heart that it was possible for him to be a Christian and be gay at the same time. He said that he had really found a beautiful peace with God in his sexuality and also his sexual orientation. Well, this guy, Dawson, proceeded to hammer this kid and tell him that he was no greater than a murderer or a rapist and that he was going to hell. And basically what he did was he took this kid's beautiful spark of light. He just brought the kid into just tears. And by the time they hung up, I just knew. I was like, you know what? This guy could be putting this kid in a body bag tonight. And then I thought about all the other people that were listening in and believing what this man of hate who was representing Christianity was saying to this kid. And believing that that was true, and it just made me so angry that I ran home, and I didn't know what else to do but get on my piano and write. And I know that the only way for any of that to change is for those of us who have stood in the light and felt the light and have also acknowledged ourselves to be self-affirming and let other people see us be that way and set an example. You know, that's what Show Me in Red is all about.
If you define the music on tonight's show as Christian music done by openly gay, lesbian, bi, and transgendered artists, then this field of music probably starts around 1987, when Marcia Stevens released her first solo album after coming out. But I want to go back to the 1950s for a singer you may not know about. Bayard Rustin should be famous as being one of our gay heroes, but the gay angle was very much played down during his 1950s and 60s civil rights activism. And Rustin was a master strategist, perhaps best remembered as the organizer of the 1963 March on Washington, one of the largest nonviolent protests ever held in the United States. He was a key advisor to Martin Luther King Jr. and helped influence King in taking a peaceful approach to the civil rights movement. Despite these achievements, he was fired from important leadership positions, largely because he was an openly gay man in a fiercely homophobic era. And he was also a singer of gospel music, and in the early 1950s recorded an album called Elizabethan Songs and Negro Spirituals. Two of his spirituals were Ezekiel Saw the Wheel and Lonesome Valley.
Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel way in the middle of the air. And a bigger wheel run by faith, and a little wheel run by the grace of God. It's a wheel in a wheel. Way in the middle of the air. Oh, watch my brother how you walk on the cross. Way in the middle of the air. Your foot might slip and your soul be lost. Way in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel. Way up in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel. Way in the middle of the air. And the bigger wheel run by faith. And the little wheel run by the grace of God. It's a wheel within a wheel. Way in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel. Way up in the middle of the air, Ezekiel saw the wheel turning way in the middle of the air. The big wheel run by faith, by the grace of God, it's a wheel in a wheel way in the middle of the air.
And when the sixth hour was come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which is being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?
I must walk my lonesome valley. I got to walk it for myself. Nobody else can walk it for me. I got to walk it for myself. I must go and stand my trial. I got to stand it for myself. Nobody else can stand it for me. I got to stand it for myself. Jesus walked his lonesome valley. He had to walk it for himself. Nobody else could walk it for him. He had to walk it for himself.
Choosing music for this show, I was well aware of the many gay and lesbian chorus albums containing religious songs. But as the focus of most of those choruses is not on religion, I felt they generally did not fit. But I'm making an exception for this group. The San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus was the first gay chorus to record an album in 1981, appropriately called the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus Tours America 1981. And the song you heard was Behold Man. I'm very pleased now to bring you an interview with Marcia Stevens, and I want to begin with the song that started it all for her. When she was 16, she wrote For Those Tears I Died, also known as Come to the Water, and it quickly became a hit in the blossoming field that was to become contemporary Christian music. She recorded the song in 1970 as a member of the group Children of the Day.
I just
Been called the mother of contemporary Christian music. What does that actually mean, and why is that said?
Well, it's certainly not because I'm the most prolific or the most well-known. It's just that the very first song that I wrote for Those Years I Died happened to be the first song that fell into that genre of contemporary Christian music that was published. And so because it, you know, I just happened to write it at the time when, of course, it wasn't even named contemporary Christian music when I wrote it, but I just happened to write it at that time, and that was the first song that sort of, you know, went around the world and got translated in different languages and stuff. So they, the people that were writing the histories of the era said, well, you know, she wrote the first song, and she sang in the first group that was called a contemporary Christian group. So that's what the guy that wrote the Encyclopedia of Contemporary Christian Music dubbed me. I thought it was pretty cool. I was honored.
I know a lot of my listeners know this story, but for those who don't, I would like to hear about the song For Those Tears I Died and what happened after that.
Yeah, it was weird to write that first song. Naturally, I wrote it for strictly personal purposes. All my friends were hippies, and being able to talk about ideas was a big deal, and I kind of hit upon the idea of writing a song about my experience with Christ because it would seem less hackneyed to my kid sister and my friends if I put it in my own words and had my own thing about it. And I sang it for my kid sister and my friends at school, and really I was done with it. I was astounded that people started to sing it. I had no idea that that would happen. In fact, it was only 2 weeks later that I had a friend call me back and say, oh, I heard this great song at church, and I know you're into music, so you'll love this song. And she sang me my song. And about a month later, Pat Boone called my house, actually physically called my house. I picked up the phone, and it was Pat Boone on the phone. And he asked if he could sing my song. And I thought, well, heck, like, sure, go ahead, you know. And, it, you know, the song just really took off without me. It went around the world. I got translations of it in about, I think at one point I had it in 12 different languages. It was just like a huge reaction to that song. And that was my senior year in high school, so I got a music scholarship to Bible college. And as it happened, the choir in the Bible college was touring Europe and Israel that year. So because the other people in the group and I were there on scholarship, they allowed my kid sister, who was also in the group, to come with the choir. And we'd been singing the choir, and then in the interim, the group would sing. So that meant that the group got heard all over Europe, and we opened for Billy Graham at the First Jerusalem Conference on Biblical Prophecy. And by the time we got back to Norway, Catherine Kuhlman called and flew us home to do a TV special. And, you know, it just sort of, like, took off. It was like a whirlwind.
Here's a little of another song from the First Children of the Day album.
When the room is dark and empty and night shadows start to fall, and when the leaves of evening make the writing on your wall, when it gets to be too frightening, shadows lurking left and right, don't try to drive the darkness out, you just turn on the light. We're the children of the light, and we're the children of the day. We need not always stumble in an ever darker way. Though the darkness may close in around with shadows everywhere, still Jesus Christ is in our hearts, the light of the world is there. When your heart is dark and empty and you shadow.
So when did Children of the Day start?
We actually sang that year, my senior year, we sang at a talent show at school. We hadn't named ourselves yet, but that was the first time that we actually sang together publicly. And then that summer when we auditioned for college scholarships, by then we gave ourselves a name.
So you were in the group a number of years, you were married, and you came out.
Yeah, I married one of the guys in the group, and we had a perfectly okay relationship. It's just that we didn't have much of a physical relationship. And even when I realized I was gay, we kind of said, well, why don't we just have a platonic relationship? Not like we hate each other's guts, but we'll stay together for the kids. But, like, you know, we get along fine. We make perfectly good co-parents, so why not stay together? And he actually got tired of it, which I don't blame him for, but I mean, people think of it as something different than it was. You know, he kind of said, you know, after a couple of years, this really isn't working for me. So I think you need to start looking for somewhere else to get your attention, and we need to start, you know, moving on. And we actually planned to stay together till the end of the year so that we wouldn't mess up our taxes, and started out very civil until the church got a hold of it.
And it went downhill from there?
Well, it started out with what I would call a pseudo-spirituality, like, well, I've known for years. And I'm thinking, you have? Why didn't you tell me? You know, it was almost what convinced me that I really was gay, because until then I would have said that being gay was an activity, not a being, you know. And once people at the church started saying, oh, I've known for years that you were gay, I'm thinking, oh, so I really am. I'm not just doing a thing, you know, I'm not just making love to a woman. I actually am a gay person. And I don't think that they probably really meant to do that, but I thought, well, if they knew before I knew, then I must really be gay. And, you know, basically they didn't want me to sing any place that the group was singing anymore, and they, you know, didn't want me picking up my kids at the church school that my kids attended. They, you know, started getting really cautious about where I could be and what I could do. And then the church in general, that was the church that I attended, but the Christian community then started really having a backlash, and people, you know, wrote me nasty letters and called me and sent me packages with pages of my songs torn out of their hymnals, all torn up in little pieces and stuff like that. So
I read that one thing you like to do is see what hymn was on the back of yours.
Yeah, they usually had to get rid of two other people. That's the cool thing about being published in a hymnal, is that they usually have to get rid of two other people to get rid of you. So that was kind of fun, because I'd put it back together to see who got torn out with me. And, you know, it was like Fanny Crosby, Charles Wesley, Bill Gaither, Ralph Carmichael. The best one was the time it was A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. I'm like, is that too cool? Me and Martin Luther. Alrighty then. I can deal with that. Yeah, that was kind of fun to see who they were willing to sacrifice to get rid of me.
About what year was that?
1979.
In 1999, Christian Century magazine said that you became conservative Christianity's worst nightmare, a Jesus-loving, Bible-believing, God-fearing lesbian Christian.
That was pretty interesting. That was a great article. I was impressed that they published it. Christian Century is a more liberal magazine, but they hold some pretty conservative points of view. It was kind of fun to, you know, be reviewed in such a big magazine after all those years.
Please tell me about the title track from You Called Us Good.
The MCC in Toronto was trying to put together a theology that was a positive theology that wasn't just, we believe that God is love and so love is good, but that, you know, was a little more meaningful than that, and yet that really kind of described some of the reasons that we feel that way. And as they were talking about it, they said that they sent me the notes from all their meetings because they wanted me to write a song about it. And one of the things they thought about is that somehow in Christianity, not only do Christians assume, but non-Christians assume that Christians assume, that a fundamental tenet of Christianity is that human beings are bad. And so, you know, fundamentally are evil and wrong and bad and must be saved, and, you know, otherwise they're going to hell, and, you know, all that stuff. And I said, you know, so one of the big things that we wanted to say was, wait a minute, you know, that's not how it started out. And it was really interesting because whenever I start writing a song, I read versions of it to people to kind of see, is it making sense to you? Do you see where I'm going with this? What don't you get, so that I can rewrite it and everything? And over again, when I started telling people, you know, I'm writing a song, You Called Us Good, many people, knowing that I'm a Christian, would say, yeah, but does the Bible say that? I thought, oh my gosh, in the first chapter of the first book, the Bible says that. But nobody seemed to know it, so I thought, well, good, we'll just make that the title cut so they can't miss it.
Created in your image from heaven's point of view. made us all so different, and yet we're just like you. You know us best, yet love us most, imperfect works of art. Others see the outer shell, but you know us by heart. You call
I know you've run into a lot of people in the Christian community not accepting you because you are gay, but have you run into gay people not accepting you because you sing Christian music?
Well, it's really funny. Mostly when I'm interviewed by primarily gay venues, it's more like that they genuinely say, why would you want to be a Christian? Like, we don't get it. You know, those are bigoted, narrow-minded people that try to make everybody else as miserable as they are and try to live by a bunch of doctrines and rules that don't really, you know, apply to real life. And why do you want to go be one of them? So it's mostly that I find people puzzled and maybe put off, but I don't ever really find... I think there's a lot of ecclesiophobia in the gay community, but there's not the same kind of hatred, I don't think, in the gay community that I run into as there is in the Christian community for the gay culture. Most of the people are just puzzled, like, what would you want to go be a Christian for? That's weird. So that's kind of a fun question to answer.
Another way I had thought of phrasing that question was, how do you respond to the reality that so many gays have only negative associations with the word Christian?
Yeah, I think people respond to that in different ways. You know, some people say, well, I won't call myself a Christian, then I'll call myself spiritual or a believer or whatever. But I kind of feel like, and people have asked why I call my music born-again lesbian music. Like, why would I want to be associated with born-again? And I just think they don't get those words. I refuse to abandon them to the enemy, you know? I love those words. I love the idea that God gives us fresh starts all the time. So they don't get to have born again. I'm not letting him take it back.
What are your concerts like?
Mostly the way that I stay out of trouble is I just tell stories and sing songs about me and my experience. Because basically, how can you argue with that, you know? It's just me and my experience. So when Cindy travels with me, that's kind of fun because... my spouse comes from a Catholic background, but she brings a whole different perspective to the concerts because she actually became a Christian at an MCC. So,
does she sing as well?
No, she doesn't at all. But she's a really good storyteller, and then I write songs about her stories.
I saw you in concert a number of years ago, and I remember having two strong impressions walking out of it. One was that your concerts should be mandatory for every member of Congress. And the other was that this is the definition of love.
That's so sweet. Thank you. That's great. Well, basically, I think that what people, like I sang at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Now, there's a good example of like one of the places that is thrilled that I'm gay. Because they're all about diversity. They were pretty wary about the fact that I would call myself an evangelical. You know, they didn't want me telling anybody they were going to hell or trying to get anybody saved or whatever. But it was really interesting because the president of the seminary and the dean of women both came to the concert. And both of them cried. The president came up afterward and he said, you know what, I left my Baptist roots behind long ago. I absolutely wasn't going to come to this concert, but you know what, you just reminded me what it's all about. And I thought, oh, that's so great. You know, I guess that's part of my whole thing is that there's not a dichotomy. We think there is, and we've been told there is, but really, there's a reconciliation and there's a healing there. It's not all about the differences.
This is Marcia Stevens-Pino, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
A good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along by looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered art music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. I hope that you especially want to visit my site this month because this is another one of my super expanded shows. You'll be able to hear the much longer internet version with many more artists and comments. And it includes special interviews with Sean Thomas and the duo Jason and DeMarco. One of my goals this month was to pack as many GLBT Christian artists as I could into this feature, because I really want to try to do the subject justice. So on the internet version, you'll be able to hear more than 50 additional artists. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Oh, why am I playing the hit song Day by Day from the 1972 musical Godspell? Well, while I have no idea if the lead singer on that song, Robin Lamont, is gay, the writer of the musical certainly is. That's Stephen Swartz, who went on to write other musicals you may have heard of, like Pippin, Children of Eden, The Baker's Wife, and the recent hit Wicked. For the rest of the show, I'm going to feature quite a variety of GLBT Christian artists. And one of the things I realized while researching this project was that very, very few of the songs they record are actually lyrically gay. Now, of course, the reason is that God is their focus and not gay politics. But can you imagine a queer music heritage show without lyrically gay music? I didn't think so. Fear not. Up next is a handful of songs that fill the bill. And the first one actually comes from a musical sponsored by the MCC Church in Dallas in 1995. The musical was called Coming Out, Coming Home, with the subtitle, A Lesbian Gay Positive Musical on Love, Truth, and God's Grace. Most of the songs were written by Stan Graner, and he and Amy Mills sang this one called Lifted by the Power of Truth.
Looking back, there were times I felt there was something really wrong with me. Crazy to think that to love alone was as simple as a sinner could be. What they said, felt the stones had been thrown, even left the church to go it on my own. But still the love of God would not leave me alone, trying to bring me back to the fold. Now I've been lifted by the power of truth. I'm not hiding my life away just because someone thinks that I should. Hear me stand up and say a Christian who's gay, and I gladly shout it, 'cause God made me this way. Won't you come join me today? Lifted by the power of truth.
More in the folk vein is a group called KDO and the Light. Their album from 2000 called Red October included the song Shepherd. Several years ago, there were two excellent websites on the net that featured recordings by GLBT Christian artists. The sites were Joyful Pride and Pride Christian Ministries. Sadly, they are no more, but one of the artists I found on those sites was Joe Warner. From his album from 2000 called Worthy is the song The Agenda.
Caught in the rain. I wasn't in Kansas anymore. No, no, no. No, 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 no. They said you're living, living, living that gay agenda. You're working, working, working that gay agenda. Stop pushing, pushing, pushing that gay agenda.
This next song, and it's one of my favorites. This will mark the fourth time I've played it on Queer Music Heritage, and other than on my Christmas shows, it's very unusual for me to repeat songs, because there are just too many songs I've not played at all yet. But as I've said, I can't resist this one. From the 1995 album The Sacred and the Queer, here's Jalen Ricks and I Saw Jesus Down at Stonewall.
Are ringing. The members wear their best. In the pews they are waiting for their holy guest. And the pastor knows his sermon. The choir stands in rows. There's a sense that something's missing, 'cause the guest
Just as I was writing the script for the show, I got an email from Sean Thomas announcing his new CD called Faith Unashamed. And I was delighted to see that the CD contained a song called Not Gay Enough for You. I called Sean and got this comment about why he wrote the song.
Well, the song was, I guess, inspired from the past couple of years that I've been touring through churches, and not only to gay-affirming churches, but also to some straight churches. And one of the things that I was finding was not only were some of the more conservative or straight churches or people from a conservative religious background having a hard time understanding someone who was gay and also proclaiming their faith as a Christian, but I was also finding that to be true in the gay community, and that a lot of times the gay community doesn't accept faith or doesn't seem to Christianity as something that can be part of the gay society, whatever that is, quote unquote. I was getting expressions made to me saying that I wasn't being gay enough and that I wasn't being true to our society or to our culture by expressing faith and by expressing myself as a Christian. And so the song is meant to be tongue-in-cheek. It's kind of, you know, a joke, but at the same time, it's got a message to it. And so, and most of the time, it seems to be received that way at the churches.
Trying to turn me inside out. I'm not hiding anything that I'm about. You can spin it any way that you believe, but you're not fooling me. You think I don't say enough about the life I lead. You don't get that it's all about God, not me. This is not an opportunity to see how big a flame I can be. Sorry, man, I guess I'm never going to walk right. And not only that, I never seem to talk right. You want someone to show me how.
Sean Thomas. Oh, incidentally, the piano music you heard in the background under many of the interview quotes on the show came from the 2001 album Prayer Circle by Judy Blackwelder. I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I have a number of other people to thank. Of course, first is Marcia Stevens, because it would not even have made sense to do this show without trying to capture some of her story. For those of you who visit my internet site, You can hear more of the show, including special interviews with Sean Thomas and Jason and DeMarco. So I thank them, and I thank Terry Lee Owsley and Danny Riddle for providing me with their own music and the music of some of the other artists. I thank my partner Jeff for his input and help in selecting songs. My internet show, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. When I first got the idea a few months ago to do a show on gay Christian music, I immediately knew what my closing song would be. Because musically and lyrically, to me, it's the best song to capture what this show is about. And logically, it's by Marcia Stevens. My favorite of all your songs is No Matter What Way.
That was a hard one to write, because that was the first time that I, really used absolutely in-your-face queer language in a Christian song. I wasn't sure how it would go over.
How did it go over?
Oh gosh, it was great. I've actually sung that with several gay choruses and sang at a lot of pride events and stuff. The core idea of it came from a time when I was out with a bunch of church people visiting AIDS hospices on Christmas Day, and I guess that was sort of an odd thing. I didn't think of it as odd, but I guess people typically do it on a different day other than Christmas Day itself. So even though there's a lot of churches that do visitation, and not a lot of them do it on Christmas Day itself, but we just were having a great time. We, got to visit all these hospices, and then we all stopped for lunch. And this guy came up to the table from another table and said, I just want you to know that I've picked up your check. You guys have just made my day. And we said, oh, my gosh, sit down. What are you talking about? And he said, no, I don't want to join you. He said, I was just sitting here feeling like bah humbug. I hate Christmas. Everybody's a phony. And you guys just looked like you were so loving and having so much fun that I wanted to pick up your tab. So why are you having so much fun? What have you done today? We went, visiting AIDS hospital. Anyway, it turned out he was gay and his partner had AIDS, and it was just like so cool. But he'd already picked up the tab. And so we went to church that night, and whoever was doing communion said, well, here we come to another table where somebody else picked up the tab. I thought, wow, what a great line. What a great way to see communion. Yep, we were having dinner and somebody else picked up the tab.
Your song again.
have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
If you enjoy the angelic sound of the harp, please come to the Holiday Harp Concert at the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts. The high school, in partnership with Johnson Middle School Heart Ensemble, will be teaming up for this special event. We welcome you December 1st at 7:30 p.m. for the performance of your life. The concert takes place at the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts, located at 4001 Starford. We hope to see you there. This is KPFT, Houston.
Join the Pacifica Radio Archives for our fifth annual national broadcast on all five Pacifica stations. Voices for Peace and Nonviolence.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.